In our prayer with Jacob, he talked about the very foundational concept that affects how we think about this subject of suicide, the value of human life. Where do you find a passage that discusses the value of human life as it relates to taking human life? Genesis 9, verse 6, right? Genesis chapter 9, verse 6. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. So in Genesis 1, in the creation account, contrary to all the other things that God made, both plants and animals, only man is said to be made in the image of God. And here in Genesis 9, after the flood, Noah is instructed that because man is made in his image, should someone murder their fellow man, they are to be put to death. And even if a beast takes a man's life, the beast is to be punished, thus exalting the dignity of human life and the reason given he's made in the image of God. We studied that in our class on Wednesday night, and we began looking at some examples in our study. We pointed out in our study that the examples that are found in your Bible are sometimes examples to follow, and sometimes they're examples not to follow. We saw specifically that Paul said these things are written for our instruction. And so these examples are there by the Holy Spirit's wisdom and power for us to learn from. We considered in our study on Wednesday Job. Job is particularly pertinent to our study because Job was facing maybe one of the major reasons people consider suicide. And that is physical pain and suffering without any seeming hope of getting better. Add to Job's situation what many people do not have. The fact that his dear friends were saying it's because he's a sinner, and he knew that was not the case. Even his wife had abandoned her faith, told him to curse God and die. When Christians today face indescribable suffering, other Christians understand that it's not because of a life of sin that they're being punished. And certainly oftentimes people have a mate to stand by their side to encourage them in their faith. Job didn't have that. Throughout the book, he talks about the fact he couldn't sleep. He had pain. He had scales all over his skin. They ran. He was even a horror to look at. And yet not once in the book, 42 chapters, do you ever see Job contemplating suicide? Not once, that I recall. Over and over again, he asked why. Why does God let him live? He would have liked to die. And he could have taken his life or asked somebody to take his life. But never do we find that in the book. In the book of James in chapter 5, brethren who are suffering, not necessarily the same way Job was, but brethren who are suffering are admonished to consider Job. And so Job does serve as an example for us in whatever sufferings we may face, whether it's from the oppression of others, as in James, whether it's from the oppression of illness or pain, as with Job. So who do we want to follow? Whose steps do we want to walk in? When we leave this earth, how do we want our children, our grandchildren, and our brethren to remember us? Like a Job? Or like someone who couldn't face the difficulties of life and gave it up? I've been privileged in the short time I've lived to be with people who were suffering and knew they would not get well. But they faced it courageously because of their faith. And that's had a great impact, positive impact on me. And there's others in this audience that I could call your names who've seen the same thing. And so you have the benefit of those examples, like Job. I want to back up in our lesson. On your sheet, I have some examples that are not to be followed. Before we look at the other examples of faith, let's look at these that we have listed. Let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 17. 2 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 23. I didn't write any questions for these on your lesson. We just listed these and asked, are they examples for us to follow? And so here is Ahithophel. Look at, first of all, chapter 16 and verse 23. In 2 Samuel 16 and 23, you see Ahithophel's position and how he was esteemed. The advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one inquired of the word of God. So was all the advice of Ahithophel regarded by both David and Absalom. So he was a man of very high esteem by the king and by his son. And apparently in Israel, man of high esteem. You remember when Absalom, however, rebelled against David, Ahithophel turned against David and attempted to assist Absalom in putting David to death. And so his counsel, however, was not followed. And so in 2 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 23, when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey and arose and went to his home, to his city, and set his house in order and strangled himself. Thus he died and was buried in the grave of his father. When you read that, if someone asks you, why did Ahithophel commit suicide, what would be your answer? And I'm not looking for the fact that his advice wasn't followed. What is the moral answer? Pride, isn't it? Pride. And I found it interesting going through these cases that I've got listed, not in every one, but in several of them, that's really what seems to be behind this decision. He's shamed, he's humiliated. Does it mean that he had no use anymore? It doesn't mean that. We don't know what would have happened. But his pride. And so he committed suicide. Obviously, Ahithophel would not be considered one that we would want to follow. Look at Psalm chapter 41. And verse 9. Maybe these two verses I'm going to read in Psalm further explain why Ahithophel felt like there was no hope for him any longer. If these are about Ahithophel, I can't be certain. But they certainly sound like they fit Ahithophel. These are Psalms by David. And Ahithophel had turned against David to assist Absalom, his son, in taking the throne and killing David. Psalm 41 and verse 9, he said, even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted his heel against me. Here was his close advisor, someone he went to for counsel and guidance in administering the affairs of the kingdom, and he turns against him. You ever felt that with someone? David did. David didn't commit suicide, but Ahithophel did. Look in chapter 55 of the Psalms, 55th Psalm. Look at verse 12. You'll note at the superscription at the top, it's another psalm by David. And in verse 12, it is not an enemy who reproaches me, for then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me, who has exalted himself against me, but then I could hide myself from him. But it is you, a man, my equal. Over in the marginal note on my equal, you'll see literally according to my valuation. And what this says is David highly esteemed Ahithophel before. these events that occurred. So my equal, my companion and my familiar friend, we who had sweet fellowship together, walked in the house of God in the throng. So here's a fellow who's evidently a very close associate of David, one he talked with, shared very private and important matters with, and he turned against him. And so then Ahithophel, maybe he thought there's just no way of ever gaining David's favor back. Maybe he felt really bad about what had happened and how he had treated David. I do not know. There's not any more information given than that. People can feel so bad about what they've done that maybe they think the only way out is just to commit suicide. That's Ahithophel. Any other comments on this one before we move to the next one? Okay, let's look at Zimri, 1 Kings 16:18. You back up a little bit of this chapter. Things were going great for Zimri for just a little while. Go back to verse 8. In the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, Elah the son of Baasha became king over Israel at Tirzah and reigned 2 years. His servant Zimri, commander of half of his chariots, conspired against him. Now he was at Tirzah drinking himself drunk in the house of Arsa, who was over the household at Tirzah. Then Zimri went in and struck him and put him to death in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, and became king in his place. It came about when he became king, as soon as he had sat on the throne, that he killed all the household of Baasha. He did not leave a single male, neither of his relatives nor of his friends. And so these are glory days. They're going to be very sharp, but they're glory days for Zimri. Instead of simply being a ruler of half his chariots, he's now the top man in the kingdom. He's killed the king and he was drunk. Didn't he deserve to die after all? But as you keep reading a little bit further, in the 15th verse, in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, Zimri reigned 7 days at Tirzah. Now the people were camped against Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines. The people who were camped heard it said, Zimri has conspired and has also struck down the king. Therefore, all Israel made Omri, the commander of the army, king over Israel that day in the camp. Then Omri and all Israel with him went up to Gibbethon and besieged Tirzah. When Zimri saw that the city was taken, he went into the citadel of the king's house and burned the king's house over him with fire and died because of his sins which he sinned, doing evil in the sight of the Lord, walking in the way of Jeroboam, and in his sin which he did, making Israel sin. Very short-lived glory. Interesting that he only reigned 7 days, verse 15. And so, what would you say caused Zimri to commit suicide? Pride? It sure looks like pride again. At least plays a part, doesn't it? You might think that he feared what they'd do to him. Would they take him out, stone him, flog him? I don't know. But I'll tell you what, setting fire on the citadel where he's in and being burned to death doesn't sound like a very good end. So I don't know if it's that he feared what they would do or so much the shame and the humiliation of reigning in glory for 7 days. And now it's pretty obvious, at least to him, that he's going to die. So he just hastens the event and kills himself. Any other? Yes.
Depression overwhelms them. The only step is take my life.
That's a good point. You wonder, not a whole lot said about it, both in the case of Ahithophel and Zimri, but depression is a big thing in the news today, isn't it? People get depressed, and so when they're depressed, they do all kinds of things. And it's become an excuse for failure in duty. Was Ahithophel depressed? I imagine you could call him pretty much depressed. Same thing with Zimri. And so that's a good point that Wally makes. But are these the guys you want to follow? Yes, Ennis?
Today, one of the reasons why the word depressed is used so much is because this opens the door for drugs that can So we need a psychologist to help him.
Are you suggesting that drug companies would tell people something so they could just sell drugs?
Yes.
Yes, that's very possible what Annie says, and certainly true. But yes, ma'am.
I think that the root of it all is, you know, he sinned up at the evil of Jeroboam. We're seeing a man who did not trust in God. This is the root of it. He trusts in not only himself, but in false gods. And he did evil. You know? So he was evil.
This is a good point Linda makes. He was evidently a sinful man. But what about Ahithophel? We don't know much about him. But he was David's counselor. You would think he was a worshiper of Jehovah, wouldn't you? We don't know for sure. But you know, when you talk about depression, if you get up on this pew here and you fall down, it's not very far. What if it's a 12-foot ladder and you fall? And both these men were on the 12-foot ladder. They were so full of pride. And it may be when we think so highly of ourselves that we're setting ourselves up for that terrible fall when the ladder's taken away. Yes, Sally?
Well, Ahithophel was Bathsheba's grandfather. And if he had lost favor with David over the incident with Bathsheba, and he was trying to get Absalom to do something to pay David back for that, and then Absalom wouldn't do what he wanted him to do. To me, he lost faith as far as his family was concerned in that.
That's possible. We don't know, but Sally's brought up a good point. Ahithophel was Bathsheba's grandfather. Did some of his actions in aligning himself with Absalom trace back to that? But even if it did, and she may be right, we don't know. What about those years that he was David's close counselor? Did he put that all out of his mind? Now see a chance for revenge? I don't know. I just know he's not held up as an exemplary character that we want to follow. Yes.
It's just a reminder, Steve, to all of us that we might conclude we would never be challenged with this. This is not something we should worry about. But godly people can be on a high for a while and then on a low for a while, and it's how you deal with that.
Good point. And what we need to do is work on boasting in the cross and not in ourselves. What Paul said, I boast in the cross. You think how Paul could have become depressed, having lived the life he did, ascending in the Jewish system. Glory and fame awaited him. Now he finds out he's wrong. He's killed innocent people or had a part in it, imprisoning people. You can imagine to be up there and now he said, I'm a transgressor, a persecutor, I've been wrong. And he could have just let that drive him into a depression where he was never of use to anything. But he didn't. He counted himself saved by grace, rejoiced to be put in the service. Paul wasn't the center of his thinking. Christ was. And as Rod pointed out, it can happen to any of us. So we need to be, this pride thing is a very subtle thing. It's hard to put your finger on, but such a dangerous thing. Yes, Ennis? Good point. He thought himself the chief of the sinners, but he trusted in the grace of Jesus Christ, and the glory was not his, but Christ. Yes.
We talked a little bit in our last class about how this affects or could affect family or whatever, and Ahithophel, the city, went back and he put his house in order. I had a friend that committed suicide several years ago, and we found out, several of us that knew him, thought we knew him real well, at the funeral, that he had called each one of us the day before he did this and had conversations with us. But the thing deceiving about that, there's nothing that will destruct a house more than an action like this, and which is evident of what happened with his family after this happened. Because this was a person that was had some troubles in life, but basically was living a pretty good life and no reason for this to happen.
That's a good observation. You know, you may think, well, I don't want to hurt anybody else. I just want out. But you can't avoid that, can you? We talked about in our Wednesday night class something outside of Genesis 9 that would affect our decision about this. And it's a pretty important law. What is it? Love your neighbor as yourself. How will this impact others? Love does no harm to a neighbor. What if that neighbor is your wife, your children, your co-workers? Good point that Jeff makes. And not that he intended to hurt anybody. But you're gone from the scene. You can't stop that. Yeah, I see a hand over here. Comment? No? Okay. Let's look at Saul. 1 Samuel 31. I don't guess I even have to ask this question. You know the answer. If you're familiar with this man, was he a prideful man?
Yes.
Pretty obvious, wasn't it? Back when David was just a young man and came and began to win those battles and the people were having parades in David's honor. Remember how Saul became suspicious? Well, you want the kingdom, you want my throne. All that was untrue. A lot of that stemmed from his pride. And then he would want to kill David. It's interesting a lot about Saul because when he got quote unquote depressed, it talks about an evil spirit. I don't think that's a demon. It's a terrible disposition. We'd probably use the term depressed. Do you remember what he did to try to get over that?
Called David to play
his instruments. Music is soothing. And that would help him with that. And so here's a man maybe given to depression. So anyway, we get to 1 Samuel 31. He's in a battle. He sees he's not going to win the battle. The end is obvious. And maybe he fears what the enemy's going to do to him. He's been in battle with these people all of his kingly life. What will they do to him? Will they hold him up as an object of shame and ridicule and fasten him to a wall? Will they blind him like they did Samson? What will they do to him? Don't know, but 1 Samuel 31:4, Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and pierce me through with it. Otherwise, these uncircumcised will come and pierce me through, and make sport of me. But his armor bearer would not, for he's greatly afraid. So Saul took his sword and fell on it. When his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. Well, wasn't that the smart thing to do, really? I mean, he knows they're going to kill him. Why not just kill himself? Why not just kill himself?
Against the law of God.
What law? I agree with you.
Your life
belongs to God. He's made in the image of God, right? Do I have the right to take a life, even if it's my own, made in the image of God? We'll look at some more examples. We looked at Job. Evidently, Job didn't think so. And we'll see some others. So it may seem like the smart thing to do, especially if you're a humanist. You don't believe in God. Man's the highest being there is. Or an evolutionist, or an atheist, or an agnostic. But if you are a believer in God, and you believe what we read in Genesis 1:26 and 9:6, if you believe that love your neighbor is the second greatest commandment, these are other considerations that would bear in making that kind of a decision. We don't know for certain, but it's thought, Jewish tradition says that his armor bearer was a fellow you're familiar with, Doeg the Edomite. Remember Doeg? He was responsible for the priest being killed by misrepresenting them and David. And so I don't know if that was Doeg or not, but if it was, again, you see the pride that would enter in and may partly explain his decision as well.
We also see that Saul is a character of fear. You know, even back on the days that Goliath was dead, in 17:11, it talks about Saul being sorely afraid. He has always been afraid. He's a coward.
and because he didn't trust in the Lord.
Okay, good point. Saul was a man who was afflicted with fear because he didn't trust in the Lord. And you see that throughout his life, a number of things that happened. Not only Goliath, but when he was supposed to wait for Samuel and he couldn't wait, he said. Things like that. And so that's a good point that Linda makes. And so it's that genuine trust in the Lord to help us face whatever comes, to help us face the most difficult issues that we're going to face in life. John?
Nowadays, like this lady here, you know, weeks ago, committed suicide. It's this idea, well, I don't want to go through these things. I mean, here's the perfect answer right here. You know, here's somebody who doesn't want to be tortured, doesn't want to end life in that way. I'm going to die anyway. Why go through the torture? Why go through the pain? Why go through the agony? Just make it short and sweet, you know. And to me, this is the best example. When people talk about that, just go right here.
Good point, and let's suppose it's not the enemy making sport of you, but a disease robs you of your ability to speak, maybe. You lose your hair. Maybe it ruins your skin. Just things that you would hate to face. Now, get your sword. If not, why not? And why didn't Job do it? So that's a good point that John makes. And you think of Paul in the book of Acts about this making sport of. In Philippi, what did they do with Paul in Philippi when they arrested him? Remember? He was whipped. If you knew you were going to be flogged, and they didn't count like the Jews, forget the 39. I mean, your flesh is going to be torn from your body. You've served God all these years. You know that's what's going to happen. Wouldn't suicide be a lot easier option? Yeah, that's true. It's true, isn't it? They use drugs now to try to make it painless.
Suicide is a selfish decision. Because you don't know what kind of impact the rest of your life will have on other people. I mean, you and I both know that in the way that Dad passed away. And the impact that he had throughout his life and then and through his sickness of 3 months before he did pass away. You know, he could have, if he was living in Oregon, just requested somebody to inject drugs into him and die like this woman that kind of brought about this study, but the impact of your life and how you choose to live it until the end, the way you decide to turn your overcome the call, has an impact on other people. It's a very selfish decision, regardless of why you make it. It's a very selfish decision, especially as a Christian, because one, it's wrong, but two, what kind of impact your life can have, regardless of how long or how short it is, on those people around you, kind of like the Jefferson you felt to, and how it can destroy families and it can destroy friends.
That's an excellent illustration, and I wished I could, I can, but I don't want to do it because I'll embarrass people. I wish I could mention names right now. I know of people who have contemplated suicide, and they didn't. And because they didn't, other people have been brought to Christ. Some of these people you know. I'm not going to tell you who they are, but I just happen to know that. So you don't know. That's a good point that Keith makes. Suicide can be very selfish. Okay? Good point. All right, let's look at the next one here. Abimelech, Judges 9:54. What caused him to commit suicide or have somebody kill him? What was it? Why did he say he wanted to be killed? Didn't want a woman to get the credit. Is that pride? He called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, so that it will not be said of me, a woman slew him." So the young man pierced him through, and he died. So you can not only kill yourself, you can command your someone else to kill you. And so, in this particular case, look at verse 53. What shape was Abimelech in? Crushed his skull. Well, why not get somebody to kill you? Your skull's been able to be crushed. It has been crushed. What's the rest of your life like? And so he had somebody kill him. Maybe the most famous case is the next one, and that's Judas. Matthew 27:5. And it says he threw the pieces of silver into the temple treasury and departed and went and hanged himself. You have to wonder about Judas. There's some unanswered questions. At least there, I can't give you the answers. When Judas betrayed Jesus, he did it for the 30 pieces of silver. Did he never think really Jesus would ever be crucified? Because he knew he was innocent. Did he think they wouldn't have enough case against him, but he had the money in his pocket? And then when he saw it didn't work out that way, man, this didn't turn out right. And obviously, as Linda pointed out a while ago with Saul, here's Judas. Did he not trust in the grace of Jesus Christ? Of course, none of these men understood the suffering Messiah, did they? And would God have forgiven Judas had he repented? I have no doubt about it. And yet God knew long before that he wouldn't. And so I don't care how horrendous the sin is. Saul killed Christians. Saul was a persecutor of Jesus, and yet God forgave him. And so even on the cross, Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing." The very people who were responsible for his crucifixion. When they repented, they would be forgiven. Why not Judas? And so it doesn't make any difference what we do, how bad it is. And now we think, my sin is just too bad. Really? Read Saul. He said, as Ennis pointed out, he said, "I'm the chiefest of sinners. And I'm an example that God will forgive anybody. There's nothing anybody's done that God won't forgive you for." You could be right, Ennis. That seemed inconsistent to me. If you believe Christ the Son of God and he'd betray him. I mean, because he'd know Christ knew what he did, there'd still be no hope for him. That may be. And I have a hard time with the concept that he actually believed Christ the Son of God and still betrayed him. But you may be right. But I would have some difficulty with that. Any other comments on that? Yes, it is. You're right about that. But he was a deceptive man. He was interested in money. That's clear. Okay, so those are good observations. The jailer, we'll not read that one. You're familiar with the jailer. When he found the prisoners gone, he was going to had drew a sword and he was going to kill himself. Okay, we already looked at Job. Here's David. Here's a man who had written Psalms, part of the Bible. The Holy Spirit had empowered him to write Psalms. God had been with him, giving him victories in battle. Then he succumbed to his passion, probably in his 50s, maybe in 40s, but probably in his 50s, succumbed to his passion, committed this sin with Bathsheba. That wasn't enough. He then tried to cover it over when he couldn't. He had her husband killed, so he's now guilty of murder. And conspiracy involved his general in it, Joab. And so, I mean, he's in a big mess. And tried to cover it over for 9 months or somewhere in that period. And, of course, Nathan came and told him, "You're the man. You've sinned." And he confessed his sin. There are indications in the Psalms that during that period, because of his guilt, it just not only affected him spiritually, but physically and mentally. But nevertheless, he repents and he finds forgiveness of God. But that doesn't mean his troubles are over. Psalm 39, we'll not read the whole psalm, but it's an interesting psalm. He talks about how he wanted to say something. He said, no, I better restrain my tongue because I don't want people to blaspheme God and so forth. But he finally opens his mouth and talks about the transitness of life. But notice especially verse 10, talking to God. He says, remove your plague from me. Because of the opposition of your hand, I am perishing. With reproof, you chasten a man for iniquity. You consume as a moth what is precious to him. Surely every man is a mere breath. God told David, David, I'm going to forgive your sin. Let's say he's 55. David lived to be 70. But he said, David, because of what you've done, the sword will never depart from your house. There's going to be consequences the rest of your life. Is this what David referred to? I don't know. You can imagine the talk that went on, the hatred that went on, maybe the case with Ahithophel that Sally mentioned. But you know one thing you never find David doing? Well, more than one. One, you never find him blaming God. God, you just, that's not fair. And you never see David contemplating, I'm going to end this life. This is a mess. And David, the great man of faith. And one, when you look at a man like Job and his faith, he was such a righteous man. You look at Noah and his faith, he was a righteous man. Of course, the excelling example is Daniel. David, his redeeming feature was his faith in the grace of God. And that's how he's held out in the book of Romans in chapter 4. David is a fellow that I'm glad the Holy Spirit wrote about because it gives fellows like me hope. He was far from perfect, but he trusted in the grace of God. What a great example he was. We have all these Old Testament saints and apostles that are recorded in Hebrews 11. Look over there right quick. It's just interesting when you talk about these Old Testament men of faith. And the key word all through chapter 11, by faith, by faith, by faith. That's how they endured, by faith in God. And look at verse 36. Others experienced mockings and scourging, yes, also chains and imprisonments. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy. Wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. A lot of that we don't have a record of. But God knows each one of these men. He knows each one of them who by faith persevered. And they're held out in chapter 11 as an example of faith. They're the witnesses in the stands. Your race is hard. Your knees are weak. You're tired. Hey, let me tell you about this guy and this guy and this guy and this guy and this guy. And, of course, I have 2 Corinthians 4. We've already talked about Paul. Wish we had time to read that, but we don't. How he looked at the things that were not seen because they're eternal. Did not concentrate on the time things. While you're in Hebrews chapter 12, here's the greatest example of all. Since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. I think what he's probably talking about is the ultimate pioneer. All these were examples, but this one excels all of them. The ultimate pioneer of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. He could see past the cross, but the way to the throne to redeem his people was through the cross. For the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and sat down at the right hand of God. Hope is what's held out to the Hebrew Christians. You go through the fire of suffering and persecution or whatever it be for what's on the other side. Jesus is a supreme example. Jesus had to die. But no one wants to face the beating he took and the crucifixion. Why couldn't he have just taken his life? He'd have still died. But he didn't. And he could have. In fact, he said, no man takes my life from me. I lay it down. He allowed it to happen. So these are considerations as we contemplate. I wanted to have time to talk about David's question. David had a good question Wednesday night. What if you're in an airplane? You're a soldier. They've shot your plane. You're headed down. You've got a pistol. They've given it to you to kill yourself. What do you do? What do you do? Is it okay to put it to your head and kill yourself? Every person has to make that decision. But here's what happens with that slippery slope. You're a mother. You've got a baby. They've told you this baby will not live until it's 6 months old. It's got a terrible disease. It's going to be born malformed. What do you do? What do you do? You've been told you've got an incurable disease. Keith brought up his dad. There is no cure. No one's ever been cured of that brain cancer. What do you do? You know shame, humiliation, pain, suffering. What do you do? And so it becomes a slippery slope. You become the situation ethics. And I'm scared to death of that. I don't know what, now David asked, what about that? I don't know what I would do. That's not the issue. The question is, what should we do? That's a real good question David had. I'm afraid I probably don't have the best answer. Yes, Betty? Good point. Whatever the circumstances, just remember that Genesis 9. That's why I wanted to start there. We're made in the image of God. Thank you for your good attention and comment. The Lord willing, Wednesday night we'll begin this lesson that's on the indwelling of the Spirit. A question oftentimes on people's mind. What does it mean in the Bible when we talk about the indwelling of the Spirit?